Hello, true believers, and welcome to Dexcelsior, a podcast about the Marvel Champions living card game by Fantasy Flight Games. I'm your host, I'm John, and I am joined this week by a very special guest. He's worked on Lord of the Rings for the past 8 years. You know him, you love him. He's the cardboard slinger himself, Caleb Grace!
I like that cardboard slinger.
That's a new one. Caleb, thanks for being on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Oh, and Sam, Matt, and Carlos and Ben are here too. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I'm here.
Wow. Know your place, guys.
I will accept that we mattered less today. Caleb, the host of Cardboard of the Rings, is here. So.
Yeah, I know.
my real claim to fame.
We pull him away from Chad.
Chad will be so proud.
Oh, man. Caleb, we are so excited about having you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just realized when you said that about the co-host of Cardboard of the Rings, that'll be Chad's next intro. Will be Caleb couldn't join us today because he's hosting a Marvel podcast.
Oh, man. Well, listeners, we're going to kind of skip. This is going to be a special episode. We're going to skip through our Marvel musings and our news stuff. Since we've had such a special guest today, we want to get right to the juicy bits. We have prepared a series of questions for Caleb, who is an awesome designer. But Caleb, like, how excited are you to just be doing this game?
Oh, man, I'm stoked. Like, you mentioned I've been on Lord of the Rings for 8 years. And, you know, that was an incredible run. And Lord of the Rings is incredibly special to me. But, of course, for last, you know, several years, you start to think, you know, I can't last forever. And what will I even do? Like, after my entire time at FFG has been Lord of the Rings. And I start to wonder, like, what could possibly be as exciting to me to work on? And then we got news that we're getting the Marvel license and we're doing a Marvel card game and it's going to be cooperative. And I'm like, so I'm going to work on that, right, guys? Right? Like, you know, turn me loose. Like, Marvel is just as special to me as Lord of the Rings is. I've been reading comics forever. So, I couldn't be happier to be working on the game.
It's such an exciting IP to get. It's such a big name, too. Like, this is going to draw a whole bunch of people into card gaming that might have never touched it before.
Yeah, it's funny for me because I'm getting kind of old now. Like, to remember when I was in high school, junior high, collecting comics, it was like something you didn't talk about, right? Like, you didn't tell people that you were into comics. Like, you didn't talk about Spider-Man's secret origin. You didn't want the girls to know you knew that, you know? And now it's like everybody knows and it's cool.
That's right. Geek culture. We're taking over.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to our questions, guys. Carlos, why don't you hit us off?
Okay. Caleb, the first question we have for you today is, what lessons did you learn from previous game, mainly Lord of the Rings and Arkham, as being the other two cooperative LCGs that Fantasy Flight does, that you brought into this game?
Sure, yeah. We learned lots of really good lessons. They went straight into our vision process. You know, when we knew that we had the license and that we were making a Marvel game, it was Nate French, Michael Boggs, and myself. We sat down in a room together and started talking about, you know, what kind of game we wanted to make, and particularly, you know, how it would be different from our other cooperative games. And so we started by identifying, like, just some of the core elements that make Marvel so special. You know, things we've talked about previously, like the feeling of empowerment, fast-paced, lighthearted, you know, irreverent, fun, like these kind of things that really make it different from Lord of the Rings and Arkham, which are much more serious and kind of darker in their tone and more desperate circumstances. And so right away we knew we didn't want to make a game where you feel all the time like, oh my gosh, how are we gonna make it through this even? Where, like, a lot of times I think Arkham and Lord of the Rings, they're very difficult on purpose. That's to evoke that feeling of horror or suspense. And with Marvel, we wanted to go completely the other direction and say, let's just make a game that's less about, like, how are we going to possibly overcome this, to, hey, look what I can do, you know? And so that was a lesson, you know, that's appropriate for the IP, that basically we wanted to make a game where people just, you know, had fun instantly, or is very accessible. So I would say the biggest thing I learned personally was just trying to cut out a lot of complexity where we could, just really, really keep things very easy to pick up and play.
You mentioned something about the difficulty and that idea of Lords of Arkham. One is hopeless, the other one is almost hopeless until the last end. Do you see that, like, will Marble be an easier game overall? Or at some point, are we going to see that type of, you know, villain that just destroys us completely, consistently, like Battle of Khan Drun or something like that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, so I would say that actually ties directly into another lesson we learned. If you look at sort of the evolution of cooperative card games, you saw that Lord of the Rings started out with just kind of one mode of play. And over time, we started to get feedback that the game was really hard for people. So we introduced, you know, easy mode. But then you also had another subset of people that thought the game was too easy. So we introduced nightmare packs, you know, to make the game even harder. And then Arkham, when it was being developed, sort of just adopted this idea of modular difficulty right out of the beginning with you can modify which tokens go into the bag at the start of each game to modify the difficulty. And so we wanted to bring that to Marvel, sort of another evolution of that with the modular encounter decks, where you can take out like a harder set and put in an easier one if you want to. And then you also have the modular difficulty with the villains. You can fight villain one and just stop there. If you defeat villain one, you can call that kind of beginner mode. Then standard is like one and two, and then experts like start with two and then defeat two and three. So it was definitely a lesson we learned that we wanted people to be a kind of play at their own pace. So the idea of like, will we ever see a villain who's like just crushing everybody? I'm sure we will in some respect, but there will probably be ways to make that easier or harder so you can play it however you like.
So okay. I had a follow-up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is so having expert mode as an immediate option, does that rule out an equivalent of nightmare mode for this game, or is that just something that if you want it to be harder, you just add them a harder set and make it expert instead?
Sure. I see you trying to be sly there, Ben, and ask me questions about coming on future product. So here's the thing about those nightmare packs is they were really well received at first. People were so excited to go back and revisit like the Lord of the Rings core set and that first Shadows of Mirkwood cycle. They kind of lost popularity as time went on. And another thing we run into is just the sheer number of individual products for a game line becomes kind of unmanageable. I mean, as fans of the game, we always want more. But if you consider the reality of like brick and mortar stores who have to manage all these different products, and, you know, a game like Lord of the Rings or even Marvel can only take up so much of their bandwidth. The reality of like the game industry today is probably fewer products is better. It's less overhead. So that's maybe another lesson we're learning, is trying to figure out, yeah, how can we give players everything they want without overloading the, you know, the distributor.
On that topic, I think the next question has something to do with it. Is that what mainly contributed to the core set being made for 1 to 4 players, fully playable from the start, with no need, with a full play set, which was different than what Arkham and Lords of the Rings and others, LCGs, even the competitive ones, have done.
Oh, I'm laughing here. It's such a great question. And I'm just chuckling because the answer is not going to be at all what you think it's going to be.
Okay, but a little another thing. Did that bring any designer challenges for what you included in the core set and the quest that you and the villains that you included there too?
Oh, it definitely presented challenges, but again, maybe not the way you'd expect. So here's the story, a little behind the scenes of what happened. The original vision for the game was very much in the traditional LCG format, where both Arkham and Lord of the Rings, the game, the core set says a game for 1 to 2 players, And then somewhere on the back of the box and in the rule book, it says, you know, can be played with up to four players with the purchase of an additional core set. So that was how we started, was Marvel was going to just follow this this pattern. And so the original card count gave you everything you needed for 1 to 2 players. And then we put it on the table, you know, for a review. And just through some kind of mix-up, the bit about, you know, being for 1 to 4 players made its way to the cover instead of the back of the box. It was like right there on the cover. That was like a cooperative for players. Yeah. And so, and that was, I mean, it was just an innocent typo from somewhere. And so what happened was the people that were reviewing the product, you know, at this final approval step, they liked the product and they're excited about it. And they brought it back to us though. And they said, yeah, it says for 1 to 4 players on the cover, but there's actually not enough cards in here for 1 to 4 players. And we're like, yeah, that was just a typo. We can fix that. And they're like, well, what would it take? You know, what would it actually take to get, you know, like we could just add some more cards in, right? And nice. So that was a decision that was made sort of like at the 11th hour, was like, okay, well, let's just go for it. Let's give the fans what they want. Let's just give them everything they need. Of course, it means the price point's just a little higher. But ultimately, if you are a person who wants to play 1 to 4 players, you know, you are saving money that you don't have to buy that second copy. So yeah, it really wasn't like affecting our design process. It was kind of this like last minute decision, and it was exciting. I think sometimes we just get so busy working on the game that sometimes those questions don't even get asked until that time.
It was a great thing too. I mean, introducing this game to my board game play group is going to be so much easier this way, and it's not only saving me money, it's also helping some people that might not have been interested. I like in the case of Lords of the Rings, I have so many cards that nobody else buys them when they play with me. But in this case, this might be the first time that I see some of my friends just saying like, well, you know, we want to get onto that. So I think it was a great idea and a great business.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
For the consumer part of it.
It just feels so much better to open up, hey, one box. You don't need to buy three of the same box just to get a deck.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a follow-up question here, kind of related. When did you always have it being a co-op game, or was there a point where you're considering a competitive game?
It was always a co-op game. That was how it was presented to us. It's sort of like a directive, you know. It's like, here we're in talks with Marvel to get this license, and here's what we're going to do with it. Now we want you to go make the actual game. You know, give us your pitch.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Sam, go ahead with your questions.
Okay. So the first question is, what is your favorite card design story from the core set and why? And what is your favorite playtesting story?
Oh, okay. All right. So first, favorite card design, and then favorite playtest story. Let me start with the playtest story, because this one I know for sure. You know, me and Nate and Boggs, we did a lot of playtesting, the three of us, especially the Rhino scenario. I will probably never play Rhino again, just because I have played him like 100 times at least, you know, throughout the development of this. I've played every different, you know, version of Rhino as that was the first scenario we made. That was our proof of concept. And so we kind of reached a more refined point in the game where Rhino is more or less as he appears now. And I remember Nate played Mockingbird to stun Rhino, and I was holding Mockingbird in my hand, and so I was encouraging him that he could block for me, like he was first player. So Rhino didn't attack him because he was stunned, and then I was like, well, tell you what, why don't you defend for me with Mockingbird, and then I'll play mine next turn. And Nate, being Nate, was like, no, I think Mockingbird's really important right now. You know, I need to keep her on the table. You know, it's like he doesn't block for me and I take a bunch of damage, and then next turn he's like, I think I'm gonna thwart with Mockingbird. Like, I really feel I need to use that one thwart, you know.
That one thwart was all important.
Right, right. So this happens two turns in a row, right? I think she's got like 3 hit points.
Yeah.
So he's just like, you know, taking advantage of her one attack or her one thwart, and then I'm like, all right, you know, she's completely exhausted now. Could you maybe defend for me? And he's like, yeah, I still don't know. I kind of want to keep her on the table. And this is where Box gets in on the fun. And he's like, well, I've got a first aid in hand. And I was like, well, look, I've been taking hits left and right. I'd really appreciate some first aid. He says, no, I think I better heal Mockingbird.
That's so amazing. They're
just like trolling me really hard, you know. And it was pretty hilarious, as you know, as proven by the fact I can still remember all the details of that story.
So do you start twitching when you go to zoos and you see the rhino exhibit? Do you start twitching a little bit?
We actually had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun developing the game. It was a good balance because we got into a lot of design arguments too. But it balanced it out with just all the good-natured fun we had. Like, Nate always proclaimed that he'd rather die than defend. He didn't want to ever use his defense value. I was kind of the one pushing for, like, there is a group of cooperative players that likes to be the defender, that wants to, you know, jump in front of the hit for their teammates. And they get a lot of, you know, joy from being that kind of player. And Nate is not that player, so he thought I was crazy a little bit. He's like, why would I ever want to do that? It's just a waste of stats, you know? so he would always say, I'd rather die than defend. And we got to this situation where, like, he was really low on hit points and the villain made an extra attack, right? Like, he drew assault and it's attacking him. And this is going to kill him. And I'm like, you could defend and maybe live. He goes, nope. And he does. He gets KO.
A man's got to have his principles.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. He's such a character. It was a lot of fun working with him. So favorite design, card design. That's a less definitive story. I will just go with this one because people have been calling it out on Facebook. We were getting kind of down to the wire with the card pool, and we found we had, you know, maybe a couple open spaces. And so we were kind of, as a team, reviewing what's in the card pool and what we might need, you know, like what's missing. And I brought up this idea that, well, we don't really have like this toolbox ally, like the Lord of the Rings had Gandalf, where every time you drew him, you're like, yes, this is where the game turns around here. This is where my momentum shifts. So I was like, why don't we basically just come up with a Gandalf for our game? And that's where the Nick Fury design came from. It was like, yeah, let's have Nick Fury can be the guy who shows up and just does a bunch of great stuff, kind of like he does in the comics and the movies, you know, just
the guy
shows up out of nowhere, does something really cool, motivates everybody, and then he's like, I'm out.
Never sticks around.
Yeah. I like to use him as defense, and I justify it's an LMD Nick Fury.
There you go. Yes. The living model decoy. I love that reference.
Okay, so moving on to our next question, was something we noticed at first glance is on face value, Captain America with his shield is very similar to Black Panther. The Retaliate is one of the big ones in the stat line. And was that intentional? And, like, besides their card set, is there something setting them apart?
No, from here on out, all of our characters will just be copies. that was another part of our design goal. There will just be 18 different flavors of Iron Man.
I mean, if that's what it takes to get the Hulkbuster armor, I don't care.
There you go. So there will be, you know, ultimately some overlap between characters. Just because, you know, like a keyword like Retaliate, that's going to have to be used on more than just Black Panther, and characters who have a more of a defense focus, that's got to be more than just Spider-Man. As for like where Cap Shield came from, that was really just my love of Captain America and how he uses the shield in the comics. You know, like for sure it's going to give him a defense bonus. It would just be wrong if it didn't. And then it was like, well, that's not enough for an iconic, you know, thing like Captain America's shield. Plus one defense just doesn't cut it. Like, what else does it do? Retaliate. You know, it's that vibranium. Every time you try to hit him, it just hits back, you know. So that one was really more of like a thematic idea. Plus, also, if you're boosting your defense, then you probably want to be defending. And so the more you defend, the more you can take advantage of the retaliation. So it really had nothing to do with comparing to Black Panther. It was really just more about what is the best thing we can do for Captain America.
I like it. I like that he gets to start with his shield, too. That's pretty great.
Yeah, when Captain America, when he does come out and people get a chance to play with his suite of cards, you'll instantly see how he plays very, very different from Black Panther.
I do like how he has a bunch of different events that play around with his shield as opposed to Black Panther, where he has one event that plays around with a bunch of different upgrades.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely was like, I don't know. When I play video games, if they're Marvel games, like I always try to be Captain America because I just never get bored of throwing the shield and watching it bounce off stuff on the screen, you know. And so I really wanted to be able to do all the things that I could do with the shield in the video games. I wanted to be able to do them in the card game.
Nice.
Matt, let's go into your questions.
Okay, guys, first up, when did you decide to move away from the cycles that had been used in all the LCGs and competitive and co-op?
Sure. Yeah, that was actually part of our pitch. That's something I'm really proud of, that I think part of growing as a professional game designer is sometimes you have to also think like a salesman and think like a marketing writer. You know, it's not enough just to design good games. You have to figure out how to sell them. So, you know, like making the core set for 1 to 4 players, that was a step. Putting a tray in the box, you know, as a storage solution, that was something we wanted. Then the hero packs, the idea was like, one thing we noticed is that over time, our card games can start to feel intimidating. Like there's such a vast card pool and people are like, gee, I don't even know, where do I start? You know, like, how do I even get into this game now? It's been out for 3 or 4 years. And, We wanted to find a way around that, and we thought, you know what? What if every pack was an entry point? Every single hero pack we ever did was a pre-built deck that, if you were even the least bit interested in the game, maybe you know a hero pack drops and it's your favorite hero, so you're like, you know what? I just want to give it a try, and so you can get a taste of the game for like $15 rather than, you know, taking the whole dive for the $60 core set.
Carlos, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a follow-up on that. Even if we don't have formal cycles, are cards and our heroes and villains kind of feel like a theme? Like right now, it feels we have an Avengers theme. And
yeah.
You have Green Goblin, who is one of the main enemies of a hero in the core set. So are we going to get that feel of cycles, even if they're not proper formal cycles like other games?
Yeah, you should. That's definitely something that's on our minds, as where you know, the other missing piece of our release schedule we haven't talked about is the, you know, the scenario packs and then the story boxes. You know, that's where you get your new adventures. So everything that comes out around, you know, like a 5-6 month period should feel interrelated. So the villains you're fighting, you know, they should feel like the kind of villains that the heroes who are coming out would fight. So that, you know, if you're kind of following the game each month as new product drops, it should feel like, yeah, this makes sense. What I wanted to avoid is this sort of jarring feeling of suddenly, you know, we have this hero over here who's never even fought this villain in the comics. And that's like the two packs dropping right next to each other. We wanted to avoid that. I think it would still work. It would just, for diehard fans like myself, it would feel a little weird.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt. Next question.
Yep. Okay, this one's a bit more on the design philosophy. Now, what made you choose to include the different resource types? How did you decide which three to do, and how did you decide to go with these three plus wild?
Sure, yeah. early on, the resource types played a much bigger role in the game. Like, I think the original way we went was that you would have to use specific resource types to play specific cards. I think now you see that more in the form of kickers, like play this card, but if you spent like an energy to play it, you get a little bonus. Originally it was like you had to use an energy. And what we found in development is that just, it made it so hard to play your cards. Like the whole game became about figuring out how to even play what was in your hand. And it was really antithetical to our vision of, you know, fast paced and easy access and exciting. So we eventually moved away from the idea that you had to use specific types, but the types themselves we kept in the game because we really liked what they represented. And that was more or less kind of the three main power types that you have in the comic books, right? You have characters who are very physically impressive, right? You know, like Thor just has super strength, or She-Hulk. And so that's where the physical resource idea came from. Then you have characters who are, you know, really, really smart, kind of genius level, or maybe they have telepathic powers or they can cast spells like Doctor Strange. And that's where the idea of mental power came from, or the mental resource. And then the last one, energy, was a lot of characters have, they do like energy blasts, you know, like Iron Man shooting energy out of his power gauntlets, or Cyclops is firing a laser beam out of his eyes. So that's, we thought those three resource types more or less told the story of the different kind of power sets that there are. And then anytime you're doing, you know, like three different resource types, a wild is just fun, you know, just like this works for all of them. It becomes a very valuable feature on a card. Like we knew uniqueness in our games is always a thing. Anytime you're dealing with a property like Marvel that's built around really iconic characters, you know, we're gonna make those characters in the game. And for me personally, I feel like it cheapens a character if you can have a dozen copies of it running around. You're like, if you can have eight different Iron Mans on the table, it doesn't feel like Iron Man's very special anymore.
Oh yeah.
So to keep the characters feeling special, you know, we made this uniqueness rule of, you know, if Iron Man's in play, you can't play another one because he's already here. Which means inevitably you're going to draw a card, like an ally, that you can't play because, you know, like when I drew Mockingbird and I couldn't play her because Nate wouldn't let his die. You know, you want to make sure you can do something with that card. So you'll probably find that most of the unique allies that come with a hero will have that wild resource icon as a way of making sure that they feel valuable to you, whether you can play them or not, because if you can't play them, you can still use that wild resource.
Nice. Matt, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I do like, because we saw the Miss Marvel spoilers, and like we already had Black Widow who used genius resources to deal with the treacheries, but then now we have energy resources, and that seems to do counterattack, and then physical resources, which allows you to stun the enemy. It seems like there's these sub-themes built into each aspect where the resource will create a bit of sub-theme within it.
Yeah. And that's kind of on a case-by-case basis. You know, it's not necessarily that the physical resource is associated strongly with a particular type of effect. It's more, you know, about what was appropriate for that card. You know, if it's a stun, you could potentially have a kicker that uses a mental or an energy to deal a stun as well. It would just depend on what kind of story that card's trying to tell.
Go ahead, Sam.
So I was wondering, so you guys talked about the resource types, but how do you decide on the villain attachments what resource types you have to pay to discard them? Is that just a playtesting thing, or is that a theme idea?
We have a dartboard in our room, and it has the different resource types on it, and we wear a blindfold. And no, it really does kind of depend. And honestly, if you asked Boggs the same question, you might legitimately get a different answer for how he approaches it. I tend to approach it again from what kind of story I'm trying to tell. There might be an attachment that I feel like, well, the heroes have to be really smart in order to disarm this thing, so they have to use mental. or it might be like this is a weapon attachment, and I'm just imagining, you know, you have to be really strong to just rip it out of his hand, and so you're using a physical resource. That tends to be how I approach it.
That's so fun. You know, it's funny you mentioned the whole, originally you had to have a certain resource to pay a certain type of card, kind of like in Lord of the Rings. I was playing this game with my wife last night. I was playing Marvel, and that was one of the things that really, because she hadn't played it yet, and that was one of the things that really kind of threw her off at first was, wait, I can just use anything to pay for anything, right? I was like, yes, don't worry. That's how it works.
Yeah, that definitely came up, and I think that might be the only downside we experienced to making that change, is that it does sort of beg the question of like, well, if I can use any resource type, why do they have different ones? You know, it's kind of a natural question to ask. So we wanted to make sure that we were including enough effects, you know, like those kickers and discarding attachments and things like that, that it became obvious within a couple turns of playing the game.
I personally really like how those kickers are like the right moment. So you don't feel like you're bogged down by having to resource match all game, but when it matters a lot. So it's still very important for deck building.
Cool. I'm glad that came across.
It did. All right. Yeah. I'll get on to my questions now. So my first one kind of has to, you might hear my dog in the background. My first one has to do with kind of the process of hero designing. So are heroes designed kind of before their cards, or do you do them both simultaneously? How does that process work?
Yeah, we've been evolving that process as we've been working on the game. I think we've gone through like sort of three different methods. The first method was, you know, sort of in tandem to developing the game. Once we had a base system that we all liked and we were moving forward with, then Nate was lead on the project at that time, and it was his idea that we should sit down as a team and develop the heroes together. And so I think we would basically take an afternoon and pick one hero and say, like, Iron Man, all right? What do you think of when you think of Iron Man? And we'd start, you know, throwing ideas out there, and when we all liked a certain idea, then we'd say, okay, let's start to riff off that. Let's see what kind of cards we can come up with, you know, based around that idea. And that worked really well for that. It did. That is probably where most of the arguments happened too, is sometimes we had different feelings about different characters, and some of us had them pretty strongly. I'm pointing fingers at myself here because I'm a huge nerd. And so I'd be like, that's not how I think of that character at all. And, you know, sometimes it meant I had to expand my idea of what that character meant, and sometimes it meant I had to bring people around to see it my way. And so there was always a bit of a trade-off there.
Just excuse but, me, well, sir. I don't think that was how Iron Man's armor looked in issue number.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Iron Man was Nate's favorite, and it was great. I've told this story before, but I never get tired of it, because he really liked that first movie where Tony Stark built his, you know, Iron Man suit in a cave. And his favorite line from that movie, you know, is later on when they're trying to replicate the technology and they can't do it. And Obadiah Stane is like, Tony Stark built this yes. in a cave from a box of scraps. You know? Yeah. And he would do that every time we played. It was amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That was so much fun. Like, it just never got old.
Oh, man. Well, my next...
Yeah, so we... Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, so that's how we started out. And then from there, we just all got really busy. And so for the first wave of heroes, then it was sort of like we kind of just divvied them up. You know, it was like we don't really have time to sit down and talk this all through together because we all have different stuff. So I definitely dibs Captain America because I was like, you know, that's the one I was most excited about. And Boggs got really interested in Ms. Marvel after reading some of her comics. And so we kind of split them up like that. And then it was sort of like design what you wanted and then bring it back to the group and share and get some feedback. And now from there, it's evolved even further to now that things have we kind of settled down and you know, we're past the core set. And now we're looking to the future of the game. And every time we get started on a new wave of product, we will sit down as a team and talk about each hero. We won't develop their whole kit as a team, but we'll talk about like coming up with identity in the game for each hero, so that everyone feels like they have a good sense of where we're going to go with that character. And then at that point, we'll kind of divvy it up, like who's going to take it and do it. But what's nice about that is there should be no surprises for the rest of the team at the end when we come back with a, you know, here's sort of my first version of this hero. We should all have a pretty good idea of what to expect that's basically going to look like. And that seems to be working pretty well.
Yeah. So how did you decide on the nemesis for each hero? Was it a mechanical thing or was it lore-wise? And did it really impact the design when you thought of nemesis?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we're all just very excited that that heroes, like your identity, you should have these obligations that follow you everywhere you go, and then also nemesis that may or may not show up in the game that just, you know, makes playing the game as Spider-Man very different from playing the game as Captain Marvel, beyond just their powers, but also how the story can unfold differently. And as far as, like, which characters we chose, there were different considerations at play there. Like, for example, with Spider-Man, I think a lot of people were very surprised that his nemesis is not the Green Goblin, because that's like one of his oldest enemies and arguably his most iconic. Other people might have thought it should be Venom, you know. But ultimately, it was sort of like, well, we knew we wanted to make Green Goblin one of our first adventure packs. So we thought, well, let's not make that his nemesis then. You know, because with Spider-Man, you have so many to choose from. So I think we went with Vulture because that was his villain in the most recent or in his first Marvel movie. Michael Keaton did a great job playing very updated version of Vulture in that film. But someone like Captain Marvel, she doesn't really have the same kind of rogues gallery that someone like Spider-Man has. And so for hers, it was kind of like, well, if it's not Yon-Rogg, who is it? You know, Yon-Rogg's kind of like, that's that person's so intimately linked to her origin story that it was like, there wasn't really discussion of doing anyone else.
Let's see. Matt, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I was curious why you chose Zemo for Captain America, because it seems like Zemo would also want his own scenario, like he's very tied with Masters of Evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was another kind of tough choice. And hopefully, as more and more product gets released, it'll make sense.
Be patient is the answer. Ben, let's get on to your questions.
Okay, so I was interested. When do you decide what aspect the hero will have? So Miss Marvel is going to have protection and Captain America's going to have leadership. So when did you like assign an aspect to that pack?
Yeah, the way we do it now is like I said, when we're discussing having that meeting of, okay, these are the heroes we're doing in this wave of product. What does each hero kind of do? And at that same time, we'll talk about which aspect do we pair up with that hero? So yeah, it's just kind of a team decision. Sometimes it's a more thematic decision, like, hey guys, if we don't pair Thor with aggression, it might feel really weird to some people, you know, like,
yeah.
And then other times it's more of a logistical decision of like, look, we can't give aggression to everybody. So, you know, who makes the most sense in Justice? Or, you know, hey, this guy's kind of a leader. He could have, you know, like, so sometimes it's, yeah, sometimes it makes perfect sense. And other times it's like, well, we can't just keep putting out the same aspect over and over. So we're going to stretch what people might think defines this character and sort of focus on this lesser known part of him.
Right. Also, what do you design like the heroes first and then the aspect cards, or do you do a back and forth type of thing, or how does that work? Because it feels like Miss Marvel kind of influenced her protection cards a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit of a back and forth. I would say that for everyone involved, it typically starts with the hero card specifically, like this is kind of their gimmick, and then you use that to design their whole hero kit. And once you have that, you can actually take just that and play test it fairly well with just using the aspect cards that come in the core set. But once you have their kit, then it's sort of like, okay, what kind of aspect cards can we make that would feel like they pair very well with what this character is trying to do, but also open up the door for, other design. So that is kind of like a 1-2-3 kind of process there in terms of the order.
Oh, cool. Yeah, like I said, it seems like it works. We haven't seen any hero packs fully spoiled yet, but from the spoilers we've gotten, they seems like it worked out pretty well.
Cool, thank you.
Very integrated.
It is interesting. Like I said, I've been on Lord of the Rings for so long that I had, I had designing that kind of down to a science. Like, I knew my process and I knew it worked and I felt very comfortable. Working on Marvel is kind of a fun challenge because there is no, established process yet. So everything we're doing is figuring out, is this the best way to do it? Is this what works? Like I mentioned that you could just design a hero kit and then play test it without designing any new aspect cards first. And that was really a process that Boggs kind of discovered for himself that he really liked that. It felt like he could just get right to it. Whereas I was more, like, kind of set on the idea of I need to design the whole rebuild before I start playing it. And each kind of has like their strengths and their weaknesses. So there's no one way that it has to be done. We're just trying to figure out what works best for us.
Oh, cool.
Well, what you're doing is great so far. So keep it up.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And then, so I have another question. You went to doing a different deck for each hero, as opposed to just a bunch of cards for all the different aspects or whatever in this game. So what are some of the challenges or are there any disadvantages to doing that as opposed to just being like, we're going to just put something in for everybody? And is it what is the difficulty in doing that?
Yeah, I really see it as being all upside. Like, I really don't see the downside. Okay. Just because it is a hero pack, and like I said earlier, our vision for it is that you could just open this pack and play. And from the very beginning, like, this was part of our original vision for the game. Like, before we were even green lit, we knew we wanted to go this route. And everybody reacted to that so positively at every single level, like coworkers, executives, licensors, everybody thought this is great. It's such a strong selling point. So we never really thought about doing it any other way. And when it comes to the actual, like, rubber meets the road, and now we're doing what we said we could do. The only difficulty that I've found in that is sort of figuring out what the sort of the leftover cards should be. Because at the end of the day, you got like a 40 card pre-built deck, but you also have the double-sided identity card, the obligation, and then your nemesis set. So you basically have room for a dozen more cards, and that works out okay because you get basically one of each off-color cards times three, and then like a basic card times three. But even there, I think we settled that pretty early with the idea of whatever those cards are, they should basically encourage you to take the hero that you got in the pack and then go play them in that aspect because of how well they pair with this other card. And so I think once we landed on that idea, there were really no downsides anymore.
Yeah.
Cool.
The hero pack whole, each pack is its own deck, has just gotten nothing but positive praise from people that I've told it to and tried to pitch this game to. And I've gotten several buddies that have gotten into the game and they're like, really? It's just a whole deck there? I'm like, yeah, you can just buy a deck and play it. That was a great decision. So kudos
Thank
to you guys.
Yeah, I think the first question you guys asked me was, stuff that I had learned, and that was definitely one of the biggest things I learned. Like I kind of talked about already, just creating entry points. Like, we did one product for Lord of the Rings that came with pre-built decks. And not a lot of people picked it up because it was this like online only, and it was like $100.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it came with digital content as well. I mean, it's a fantastic product, and I love it, but not everyone's, you know, ready to take that dive. But we put pre-builds in that because working on Lord of the Rings, as long as they have, like, that was something that would come up over and over again, was people trying to figure out, how do I play this game? You know, how do I build a good deck? And what really blew me away over time was how many people said, you know, I like this game, but I don't like building decks. And I thought, really? Like a collectible card game and you don't like building decks? I would kind of chuckle, and now I take it all back. Like, the joke was on me. Keyforge has shown, like, people really love playing games when they don't have to build the deck. You know, like, that's not my personality, but there is a huge market out there for it. And so we were like, absolutely, we should just give people pre-built.
Here you go. Play this.
And try to do the best of both worlds, where, you know, if you don't like that pre-built deck, then you can totally deconstruct it and build your own.
Mm-hmm. I like the options. I think so cool. Like, you know, I don't have a friendly game store anymore where I live, but when I used to live in a city that did, you could be playing Lords of Rings and you had to have like a couple extra packs if any like random person will show up, be like, I'm interested in that. But with the pre-built decks, you'd be like, well, I mean, you can buy a hero off the shelf, play, and if you like it, then start investing in the game. I mean, you can even buy a hero and a villain and play it and then decide, okay, this is a game I like, I'm going to get the core set, which is just amazing for me. It just makes getting into the game and getting people into the game and talking about the game to other people so much easier.
Cool. Yeah, that was the idea.
Well, those are all of our main questions, but we do have some rules questions to finish out this interview. So I know you said, just, I guess, if you're not sure, I guess defer. You can say, get Michael on, interview him.
John, real quick, I had a question.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Sam.
Every card in the hero packs that are new besides uniques, are they going to be three ofs?
Yeah, if we include like a new card, you will get a complete playset of that card. We do use reprints sparingly in the hero packs just to round out the deck. There's just certain cards that are going to make that deck better because we are trying to ultimately create a point of entry to the game. That, like, any pack, every single hero pack we do could be someone's first experience with the game. And so we want to make sure that we're building a deck that gives the best experience. So we have kind of a couple competing goals, you know, like, on one hand, we're trying to expand the card pool for people who are already collecting. So we want to give them new and exciting cards and as many of those as possible. But at the same time, like you guys have kind of talked about at length now, we're also trying to reach a new audience with every single hero pack. So the rule that we kind of self-imposed is, if we create a new card, and there'll be lots of them in each hero pack, if it's an aspect card, you get a full playset. If it's a reprint though, then you might just get one or two copies, you know, because the expectation, ultimately every one of these packs says that you need the core set to play the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if it's a card that comes in the core set, you might not get a full playset of it, but I don't think anyone's going to complain about that.
No, yeah.
Yeah. I really like that because you don't need, like, three Avengers Mansions in literally every deck. You might just want one or two. So,
right.
That's a really good compromise. I'm really happy to hear that.
Cool.
Okay, so our first rules question is about the card Legal Practice in She-Hulk. So the card states, choose and discard up to 5 cards from your hand, remove 1 threat from a scheme for each card discarded this way. Does this affect, can you use this to remove threat from different schemes, or does it all have to be from the same scheme or side scheme?
The same scheme, where it says to remove threat from a scheme, that's singular, means that just one. I know the wording of it sort of leaves it open, because then it goes on to say like for each, but of course the for each is just reference each card that you discarded from your hand.
Cool. Okay. Now that makes sense. Titania's Fury. It's a card that says, when revealed, Titania attacks your hero. Am I saying that name right, by the way?
I think so. Titania.
Yeah. Okay. People give.
I suppose it could be Titania.
I know. I've heard people say it that way, and then people give crap for saying it that way, and then I'm just like.
Just saying it. Saying Spanish, there's no problem. Titania. There you go.
There you go. There it is.
Like pronunciation in Spanish.
When you say in Spanish, it feels like someone I want to like get to know.
Whoa! Not at all. Not at all. It means the same thing. It's a scary big
movie. Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, that's funny. It's Titan. Huh. So, yeah. So.
Okay. So it says, when revealed, Titania attacks your hero. Is this a normal attack that can be defended by allies or other heroes, or does she specifically attack your hero and nobody else can defend it?
Yeah, so this is one of those things, a nuance in our game that we're hoping people will be able to learn very quickly. The distinction of like attacks your hero instead of attacks you is something that we kind of stumbled upon in developing the game. If that card said attacks you, then that attack would resolve even if you were an alter ego form. And the whole idea of alter ego form that you should be safe from attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we have space on a card to do when revealed hero, when revealed alter ego, as a way of separating it out, right? Like I believe Assault says, like, when revealed hero, the villain attacks you, you know, right? When revealed alter ego, Surge. You know, that's a really nice way to handle that. But when we don't have the rule on the card, like with Titania's Fury, then we can essentially accomplish the same thing by saying it attacks your hero, so that if you are not in hero form, then you're not going to. However, if you are in hero form, it's going to resolve like any other attack.
Okay.
She will initiate the attack against you, but you could defend with an ally or someone else could defend for you.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Awesome. That is, I see now. I see now why that wording.
Yeah, it is, but it's a little nuanced. That's one of those things, like, no matter how simple we try to keep it, you know, little things sneak in there, little unintended consequences reveal themselves.
Yeah. Sam, you got the next one. Sam, are you there? Uh-oh. Did we lose Sam?
I'll take it. Go for it, Carlos. During the villain phase, when the minions attack after the villain, would Ultron drones on stage one attack if they interplay after Ultron attacks? Same goes for stage two, but that is when Ultron attacks. How does Ultron spanning drones work with Gan up?
I'm sorry, I was just really distracted. I'm worried about Sam. What happened to him? You guys all just moved on like you don't even care about him.
I mean, he's in college.
Can you guys hear anywhere?
You never know.
Yeah, we can hear you, Sam.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah,
we can hear.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, that's an old Mitch Hedberg joke where he you guys familiar with the comedian Mitch Hedberg?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's a Minnesota boy, so I gotta love him. He had a great bit about, you know, when you go to the restaurant, you know, and they're like, Donner, party of two. You know, no one shows up, and they'll be like, you know, Smith, party of four, and they're like, yeah, but what happened to the Donners?
Yeah, what happened to the Donner party?
they can be tied up in someone's trunk. And they're hungry.
Yes, I forgot about that one.
I mean, listen.
It's like Smith, search party of. You gotta find the Donners before you can eat. I totally didn't even hear the question. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you're good.
We're talking about which Ultron card are we asking about?
So let's break this question down a little bit because it's kind of a long one.
Mm-hmm.
Ultron stage one. Says after Ultron attacks, choose to either put a threat on the main scheme, or you get a drone. Does mm-hmm. that drone attack you normally?
Oh yeah.
If it's after
the drone? Because you resolve the minion attacks after the villain. So if the villain attacks and that puts a minion into play with you, then that minion is going to resolve its attack next.
Okay, and then. How do the drones work with gang up? If the villain attacks you, if a drone enters play after the villain attacks you, do they get an attack? Or does gang up check for minions already in play?
No, I think the way gang up is worded, it's like the villain and each minion engaged with you attacks. So it's going to be the villain's attack is going to resolve first and then each minion.
Ah, I see.
So if he puts a minion into play, then you're getting an attack from that as well. Yeah, he's no joke. He doesn't mess around.
He's a jerk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so our next question is, how does Repulsor Blast work? In the rules reference, it says resolve card one sentence at a time.
Mm-hmm.
If you deal the one damage, and then are you deal the additional damage, is that in addition to the one damage? Can you get rid of tough and then deal the damage?
Oh, okay. So Repulsor Blast, I don't have it memorized, but it's like, what, deal one damage to an enemy?
Let me pull it up.
It's like deal one damage to an enemy and discard the top however many cards of your deck.
And then there's a period.
Yeah, deal one damage to an enemy and discard the top five cards of your deck. For each printed energy resource discarded this way, deal two additional damage to that enemy.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I see what's tripping people up here is the use of the word additional.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that there's two sentences.
Right. The way.
Jason.
Yeah. Sorry. So that's one of the, that's actually the kind of question where I would like turn to Boggs and just make a conversation about it and be like, well, what do you think? Cause it's one of those where like you could honestly go either way. But since the, the motif of the game is empowerment, I would be inclined to say that it says deal one damage, period. You resolve that. Boom, it's done. You know, then it says discard cards. You resolve that. Then it says do more damage. I'd do that. So I, you know, if I was playing right now and that came up, I would remove the tough, I would discard the cards, and then I'd do that much more damage.
Okay. Well, we can, I guess you and Michael can confirm, and we can figure something out. Mm-hmm. Get that out to the people.
Sure.
Okay. Two more here. Explain consequential damage. Is it a step or sequence separate from the steps that make up using one of the ally's basic powers? Can consequential damage stop a triggered ability of an ally like Daredevil or Tigra? And also, if attacking or thwarting to get rid of stunned on confused on an ally, does that cancel the consequential damage?
The last one's the easiest one to answer. Like, it, you know, getting rid of a stunned or a confuse is a replacement effect. You know, it's like the next time you would do this, you remove this instead. That means you didn't actually do the thing that you tried to do. So you're not going to take consequential damage for removing a stun or a confuse. If you have a tough status card on an ally that you use, the tough will be pinged off instead of taking the consequential damage as well. I don't have like the steps like right in front of me, but I feel like I'm just going off memory here. I feel like when we talked about it, it's like the very last thing that you do is put that consequential damage on. So that makes me think that if I'm doing Daredevil, because he thwarts and then after he thwarts, he does a damage. That's right.
Yeah.
So I would thwart, I would do the damage, and then I'd put the consequential on him.
Okay.
Last of my questions was, if in the middle of revealing encounter cards, my deck gets reshuffled, do I reveal the encounter card that I just got from reshuffling?
Do you reveal it?
So, like, for example, if I reveal my card and it's Invasive AI and it discards the last cards from my deck, so I have to reshuffle and I get an encounter card, do I reveal that card that turn?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're in the middle of revealing cards. And the villain phase, right?
Yeah.
And the resolution of one effect causes you to be dealt another card.
Correct.
And you're asking, do you have to reveal that next card?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. In the villain phase, when you're revealing cards, you just reveal all of them that are in front of you, like as they come. The only time you don't reveal an encounter card is when it's dealt to you outside of that step.
Okay, cool. That makes sense. We've got just three more questions for you, Matt.
To clear something up there, my turn to reveal my cards have already passed, and a card revealed during Sam's turn, for example, makes me get an encounter card, then that would stay until the next turn, right? Or do I have to...
Oh, this came up before, too. And now I think if you read the rules reference on this issue, it's... I believe it's in there that it's like you repeat this process until no cards remain.
Ooh,
yes.
I'm pretty sure that came up is a conversation I had with Nate. So initially, it's like you're going to reveal all the cards in front of you, and then play proceeds to the next player. Now, if something happens with that next player that deals you another card, the game is going to continue. It's going to like rinse and repeat. You know, so like the last player revealed all their cards, and now the first player still has a card remaining. I believe the way it's written in the rules reference is it's going to circle back to that first player then and resolve that card. So I think that just reinforces the idea that the only time you won't flip those cards is when they're dealt to you outside of that part
that
of the
makes sense. It's yeah, like it's doing okay. A check to see if anybody has any cards left.
Pretty much. It's kind of like go until everyone's out of cards and then play proceeds.
Cool. Matt, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Okay, mine's about, I've got a few keyword stuff. Retaliate. It only works when the villain attacks that specific character. Like, if I defend with an ally, it retaliates. But if I defend while I have Black Panther, I don't get retaliate, right?
I think you might have said it a little backwards, but I think I understand your intention and you're correct. So I am Black Panther, and I get attacked by Claw, but I choose to defend with Luke Cage. So the villain attacks Luke Cage. Luke Cage takes the damage. Black Panther's no longer the target of that attack, so he no longer triggers his retaliate.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the way, and I think what's going on here is that we've gotten a few questions about different keywords based off of their reminder text, and so one thing that's important to remember is that the reminder text is not the full rules text. The full rules text, I think, is more clear.
Ah, okay. I think that might answer your question 7, Matt, about guard.
Yeah. So if you have guard, does that mean you identity card can't attack the villain, or can your allies not attack either?
Guard? Yeah. You, the player, cannot. So this is actually one of those conversations that we've been having internally is the use of the word you in the game, because it was one of our design choices that we wanted you to feel like your hero. And so instead of saying your hero over and over, you know, we like to use the word you, right? But you can sometimes be a little ambiguous of like, does you refer to my card or to me as a player? For example, if we ever did a card that says like, you know, exhaust an ally you control, you obviously refers to you as a player and not to your hero card. So yeah, it does make it a little bit ambiguous sometimes. And I think when the rules reference goes online, that's one of the biggest entries, is to clear all of that up. So yeah, guard is definitely meant to be you as a player cannot attack the villain.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, well, that leads right into my final question then. Interrogation room, it says, after you defeat a minion, remove a threat from a scheme. Does it have to be when your hero specifically attacks, or would, say, She-Hulk's response when she flips over, would that work?
Right, that's funny. So I actually answered this question one way in an email, and then had a discussion with Nate and Boggs about it, and I'm going to answer it differently here, and then that just creates all kinds of joyful confusion. I was leaning really hard into like you means hero and the events that you play are sort of an extension of you and your allies are kind of separate. I was thinking of like when I'm stunned, my ally's not stunned, you know, and so on. Pardon me. But yeah, no, this is a situation where you is you as a player. So when you as a player defeat a minion, then you can resolve that regardless of whether it was your hero or your ally.
Well, that makes me so happy.
Yeah. and I'm sorry that's not a little clearer. That's one of those things we're definitely going to keep an eye on as we move forward to try to, like, you know, just be aware of that and make it as clear as possible on every future kind of effect we do like that.
Well, I will say it was intuitively what I thought. It's only when we read the rules about, like, what you means that it kind of seemed iffy.
Yeah.
So what's actually kind of interesting here that I've run into is that people who are coming to this game from Arkham or Lord of the Rings tend to believe that things are more restrictive than they are because that's what they're used to from those games. when in reality, it's like we are really going for the most like broad, positive, upbeat kind of interpretation we can give. It really is like a completely different design philosophy. And so in general, I would just encourage people to adopt the most beneficial view.
We're all just so used to your abuse, Caleb. You've abused us so much with Lord of the Rings. We can't take it.
Yeah.
You and your surge.
You know, I couldn't make a card game without that. That's why I surge. Yeah. Same keyword in this game.
Why does biometrical upgrades have surge and not if it doesn't attach?
That's actually a really easy question to answer because that's an attachment that goes on a
minion.
Does it even go on the villain? I think it has to go on a minion.
Yeah, it has to go on a minion.
And so it's going to have surge because if there's no minion in play, it's just a dead draw, and that's supposed to be a harder encounter set.
Yeah.
So we're not going to put a dead draw in a harder encounter set.
Yeah. I really like surge because I've gone turns like where I get you draw two cards off the encounter deck, and then you surge more, and I go through six cards to the deck in one turn.
Oh my gosh. That hadn't happened to me very much. I actually feel like we use surge pretty sparingly in this game.
You definitely did not.
it's mostly when you're in alter ego mode and they can't attack you, so then they surge.
Well, yeah. Sure. I guess what I'm thinking of is if you look at how many cards just have the printed surge keyword, regardless of, it's not conditional. Like I think most of our surge is conditional. Like this card didn't do what it was meant to do, so reveal a different card instead.
Well, I still draw every expert game that I play. I draw that encounter card that which is
the double surge.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I forget about that because that was one of our kind of last minute additions was, how do we distinguish expert mode from standard? And we were talking about, you just start with the level 2 villain and you have to fight level 2 and level 3. And as a team, we kind of decided maybe that's not enough. I know Nate was really keen on the idea of saying we should put something else in there to make it even worse, make it harder. And so that's those three kind of expert cards, right? The one that double surges and the one that exhaust. I forget what the other two do.
I think there's one that pitches like a ton of threat on a side scheme. And
4 on each side scheme. And then if there's no side schemes, you search out a side scheme.
There we go. Yep.
I love expert mode. I love
that card. Actually used to be part of the standard deck.
Oh my gosh.
And the playtester feedback was like, this card's really nasty. And we're like, all right, it'll go in this expert set.
Good call.
That's Master Plan, right?
Master Plan. That's it. It's got a great picture of Red Skull.
Yeah, originally that was like, that was the sort of the threat equivalent of Gang Up. And so they were. The standard deck design was basically what does every villain we ever make need to do? And it's like, they need to scheme and they need to attack, and they need to do it at unexpected times. And so we made assault and we made advance. And then it was like, let's spice things up by throwing like a stronger version of these cards in here. And so Gang Up is like not just the villain attacks you, but the minions as well. And then Master Plan was like, he doesn't just scheme on the main scheme, it's like, but side schemes as well. And that one broke a lot of
And then you have Shadows of the Past for the Nemesis, and
That's a given. Well, man, Caleb, thanks so much for coming on. If people want to like get in touch with you or with the design team, where should they go?
You can use my work email. The way it is right now actually is if you have a rules question, you can go to, the Fantasy Flight Games webpage, go to products, go to Marvel Champions, and there's a button there that's like customer support. Like, I don't know if it says rules questions. I think it's just like customer support, and it'll send an email that gets filtered to me. And so this is the main way that I get rules questions is through this. And you'll just get a reply from me, like from my work email. Mm-hmm.
Awesome, man, thank you so much.
I have one bonus question. Can I ask?
Okay, go ahead, Matt.
Is there a possibility we get Stan Lee cameos in the cards?
I hadn't even thought about that. That's pretty cool.
Oh, there you go. when it happens, we can point to this episode.
There you go.
Well, listeners,
that's a good idea.
Oh yeah, I would love it. I would love just a Stanley cameo card. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you heard it here, if you want to get in touch with Caleb, we have a Facebook page. You can check us out on Facebook and on Discord. We'll put links in the description. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Carlos, why don't you take us home?
Excelsior, onwards and upwards.